Hello, it's great to have your company for Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. I'm Sean Delaney, and you can listen to podcasts of close to 300 previous editions of Inside Education on seandelaney.com/podcasts. This week's programme is something of a family affair. The Mulcahy family comes originally from Cork, but three of them are now working as university professors in education in the United States. They are Donal G. Mulcahy, who is professor in the School of Education and Professional Studies at Central Connecticut State University, his daughter Cara Mulcahy, who is a professor of literacy, elementary and early childhood education at Central Connecticut State University, and his son Donal E. Mulcahy, who is assistant professor and director of elementary education in the Department of Education at Wake Forest University. All three collaborated recently on a new book about education called Pedagogy, Praxis and Purpose in Education. Donal G, or Donal Senior, was a founder member of the Education Studies Association of Ireland, or the ESAI, in the 1970s. This year, the ESAI celebrated its 40th anniversary, and to mark the occasion, all three members of the Mulcahy family travelled to Ireland, and the three of them presented papers at the Association's annual conference in Cork. I travelled to Cork to meet up with the Mulcahy family and to find out more about their interests and involvement in education. In our conversation, they shared many ideas about education using their unique insights into education in both the United States and Ireland. I first asked Cara to tell me about the reference to purpose in education as written in the title of their book.
When we think about education, there's always a wide variety of purposes, oftentimes competing reasons for education. And certainly within the United States context, and Dad, Donal G, can probably address this a bit more in the Irish context, but you know, traditionally there have been competing forces such as economic reasons for educating people, civic participation reasons for educating people, literacy and religious reasons for educating people. And so I think in many cases some of those have continued forward, although they've kind of morphed and evolved and changed somewhat over the years, some gaining more focus, some kind of falling into the background a little bit more. And then new ones have started to develop, such as issues surrounding social justice, equality, even sustainability now, and global awareness have started to come into the picture a little bit as we talk about education and what are we educating toward in our schools. So they would be kind of some of the initial main topics that would jump into my head, or some of the main underlying purposes as to why, you know, education has evolved the way it has over the years. And then I think each educator probably has their own specific area that they find calling to them a little bit more than another. So, for example, if I think about myself, I am concerned with kind of issues of equity and justice, and I come from an English and literacy background, so I seek using literacy education as a way to address ways of creating more equitable and just, hopefully, society for all. Fairly lofty goal, but that's kind of what would be pushing myself forward.
I wouldn't disagree with anything Cara said. I'd say, you know, some of the purposes that we think about, I think about it from a social perspective and from an individual perspective. What kind of a society does one want? And then what emphasis do we put on the individual within that society? And I'm thinking in the US context in particular, if you think about the Puritans even, they had taxes back in the 1600s, ever before the US was a country, so that they could finance schools that would teach how to read the Bible as a part of personal development, an important part of personal development. You go on to the 1880s, 1890s, and you have a very different purpose, which is the industrialization of the United States and schools serving the purpose of essentially training factory workers, as is well documented by many historians, Tyack or Joel Spring or many others. And then, you know, you have John Dewey, a sort of a major figure, philosopher, psychologist and education scholar, who talks about the importance of prioritizing democratic practices and the ability to undertake democratic governance successfully, and the importance of a strong public school system in so doing. And so who makes policy is a good question, because you'd imagine then that people who think about this seriously would have some influence on the policy-making process. And one of the dangers, less so in this country than in America, is the education community, both scholars and teachers and practitioners of all kind, have essentially been marginalized, if not removed, from the policy production, in at least in terms of education and many other sectors as well.
Okay, and we might come back to that in just a moment. Donal G, do you want to add anything about the purpose of education?
Yes, I can, I'm sure. And I was interested for a number of years on the issues regarding the aims and purposes of schooling in Ireland, especially second-level schooling. And it seems to me that, unfortunately, there wasn't a great deal of attention given to it. And as a consequence of that, pre-existing practice seemed to sort of dictate where we would go next. And there was never really a very clear, strong, well-articulated statement of position. And as I say, that can lead to problems with regard to falling out of date, missing out on new possible developments, and so forth. But I'll also switch the topic a little bit, because in our book that I think you just mentioned at the outset, Pedagogy, Praxis and Purpose in Education, we try to identify different ways in which people talk about education and schooling. And there's no doubt that there's an endless variety of ways, but we try to identify three significant ways in which people tend to think about, talk about education and schooling. And we gave them labels because we needed to be able to refer to them frequently throughout the text, so they needed a label for ready reference. We call them, first of all, the discourse of control. Second, the discourse of what we call knowledge and understanding, which is very much related to the traditional idea of a liberal or general education. And thirdly, what we call the discourse of praxis. Now, within each of these three discourses, there is a different philosophical orientation. And the philosophical orientation of each of the three tends to be, if you like, shaped in response to a sense of purpose for schooling. In the case of the discourse of purpose, for example, there is a tendency to promote schooling as a way of supporting existing structures, supporting existing interests, and these would very often be corporate interests, political interests, and the form of schooling that emerged from this discourse of control tended to be very directive. It didn't leave a great deal of room for individual initiative by students. Then in the second discourse, which is probably the most traditional and maybe the most widely used discourse, the discourse of what we call knowledge and understanding, that was not as heavily control-oriented as the discourse of control, but it did still have two elements similar to the discourse of control, and these two similar elements were, first of all, an emphasis on a fairly traditional liberal arts education, gen ed. And there was a very famous report in Ireland in 1960 called the Report of the Council of Education on the Secondary School. And that was a classic example of a sort of a governmental statement which declared very explicitly the purpose or aim of, at the time, secondary education in Ireland was to promote a liberal arts, general education style education for pretty much everybody. The third form of discourse then that we identify, and one I think towards which we are inclined, the three of us independently, is what we call the discourse of praxis. And we see the discourse of praxis as a sort of an outcome of the thinking of people like Paulo Freire, who would have been considered to be very much in what they call the school of critical pedagogy. And the distinctive feature of praxis that we pick up on is that praxis is indeed as interested as, you know, the discourse of knowledge and understanding. It's as committed as the tradition of liberal general education to the idea of academic or intellectual formation. But unlike the more traditional version of that, it argues that we need to go beyond just an academic formation, and it would like to bring onto that then, you know, a greater awareness of the importance of educating people in engaging in action in the course of their lives. And that's very much a sort of a Paulo Freire orientation. Namely, we need to educate people to know and to think and to reflect, but we also need to educate them to engage in reflective action. And he would argue, as would others, that, you know, the formation of citizens of democratic society in particular, virtually by definition, they need to be educated not only in the classics and in history and politics, they also need to be educated in how to become engaged in actual democratic practices in society. like contributing to the well-being of the local community in a way that even young children growing up can do.
So is that a little bit like what Donal E was saying about Dewey, the Deweyan perspective?
Oh yes, very much. The discourse of praxis would draw very strongly on John Dewey and his ideas about education and pedagogy.
And these discourses, where are they happening? Say the discourse of control, the discourse of knowledge and understanding, and the discourse of praxis.
Well, we all have maybe slightly different views of that, but they occur in schools, and they are presented and supported by people who hold these different points of view. And so, for example, traditional schooling tends to promote the discourse of knowledge and understanding, traditional general education. Corporate America, for example, and conservative influential foundations, as they're called in the States, they make a very strong case for forms of education of the kind that they typically support need to be more directive. They need to be more concerned about attaining goals that support the corporate community to a degree, at least.
And that has a huge influence over the actual policy that is, in the end, sort of created. At least it has in recent years. I mean, very clearly the standards push that we see since the 80s came in with Reagan and Thatcher, sort of across this side of the Atlantic. And it came in with, as one of the assistant secretaries of education said, I think it was Chester Finn, said that, Reagan brought business to the table as never before. And the table he was referring to was the education policy creating a table, if you like. That influence of business interests influencing education policy in the form of standards, standardization, regimentation, control over teachers in particular, control over the curriculum, and thus the control over teachers. That's very much the discourse that you'd find in increasingly both conservative and quote-unquote liberal elements. The Democratic Party have bought into this sort of control of teachers discourse at the federal level and at most state levels as well.
And how do they exercise that level of control? Because they're not in the schools, they're not in the classrooms.
That's right. And, you know, their concern always is the very same question. How can we further control what's happening in the classrooms? Because there's always this saying, when teachers close the door, who knows what's happening? And teachers certainly, you know, they're in the classroom for X number of hours a day. They do as much as they can what they believe to be the right thing. But the effort has been to make the teacher as much of a non-variable in the classroom as possible by way of stripping tenure or permanence from teachers, stripping away the power of unions, dismantling unions and the collective bargaining voice of teachers, and putting them under the gun for test scores. So you have standards, and what do you have standards? You have to test on the standards, and teachers who don't score well on those tests are considered poor teachers. And so in those ways and others, but those are some of the more obvious ways, they've tried to control what happens in the classroom.
I think they also exercise their control by exercising very strong powers of lobbying. So they will lobby, you know, political representatives, members of this party or that party. And as you know, becoming elected these days, you know, anybody who's a candidate needs a pretty hefty chest, and they will contribute monies which most people would consider to be the route to access to shaping policy.
It still strikes me, though, as a little bit strange that in a system that is as fragmented as the education system is in the United States, particularly the public school system,
yes,
that it's so fragmented and the ownership or the management is so local.
Yes.
How can these corporations,
yes,
exercise such a general,
yeah,
influence? Why can't the school system be more resistant to external forces?
I think that's actually an excellent question, and it's one that I think about regularly, because you would think that there was a fairly substantial way for people to push back and resist. But what is kind of striking is that many people do seem to kind of row in behind it at times, especially in more the administrative lines, superintendents, deans of education in many cases. Some of them resist, but some of them don't seem to. And I think some of it has to go as well with the rhetoric and how people are describing it. So even when we talk about Common Core, for example, which is Common Core State Standards, which is now an initiative that's fairly widespread in the United States, and we test toward it, there's of course a certain degree of corporate financial gain behind it. There's also been people like Bill Gates, for example, had a hefty hand in the formation of the Common Core State Standards. So all of this, again, comes back to this notion that there's quite a substantial amount of corporate interest, but there's therefore financial interest in it as well. And so they kind of make the argument, or the rhetoric, I guess, that this is going to improve the economy, this is going to improve society. And when you look at the kind of the surface level of it, some of the goals sound very nice. nice and very achievable. And of course we want all students to be able to read by a certain age level. And of course we want students to do better, you know, on international test scores. And it's very hard to argue on the surface level with a lot of that. But when it's when you really start to dig beneath it, that you kind of start to see some of the larger issues that aren't always readily available on the surface.
And very often you have to ask yourself, when one thing is being promoted, what's being demoted?
Correct, exactly, yeah.
If I can touch again on the fragmentation question also, there was a time certainly when public schooling, which is a state-by-state organization of schools, there really is no national system of public schooling in the United States, and that's the point you're drawing attention to. But increasingly, national forces, like collections of conservative foundations, increasingly, the federal government is exerting much greater control over education and the funding of education. So while there is a good deal of fragmentation of the kind you talk about, there are also very powerful centralizing forces.
Including things like you're saying, Donal E., about the standards movement, for
exactly,
example.
Yeah. I mean, two very quick examples. And when standards and what they call results-based accountability, I mean, holding teachers accountable to the test scores their students achieve, really came into being in 2002 with No Child Left Behind. You know, that's a very clear example of the federal government basically saying standards are now important for every school, no matter how small, no matter how big the system, no matter how dependent on federal funds or not. Now you have to test your students and publish your scores, etc., etc. And then that's only been regarded with things like Race to the Top, where the Obama administration came in, No Child Left Behind being under Bush the second. Obama came in and said, Race to the Top is perhaps a solution. Why doesn't every state submit reform plans? How are you going to reform your public school system? And we'll give you hundreds of millions of dollars to a few of you who do the best job. But the best job was those who had the best standards. So everyone's racing to, not Race to the Top so much as Race to hyper-standardization. And in those kinds of means, they can the tentacles of standardization and federal influence, if not control, I would argue it's more vested interest control, but it's the ability to then influence all this fragmentation. And unfortunately, there isn't a unified opposition in the sense that there are the teacher unions, since it's in the literature since way back 2003, the quote-unquote meddlesome teacher unions have to be done away with. And by doing away with them in so many places, or disempowering them in so many places, there's very hard to have a collective voice to balance that sort of influence towards standardization.
And how are the unions being disempowered?
Well, some places have just banned unions completely. You can't have a union in North Carolina. They've done away with tenure. So in that situation, it's just outlawed.
And what do schools who achieve highly on these test results, what do they get? What is the gift that's being given by the federal government for doing well?
Cripes, I suppose funding is always one of the sort of rewards, though that's been complicated too, because sometimes if you do well enough, you'll lose certain funding.
I've never heard it put that way before. I've never heard of what the gift would be or what the reward is.
And because it might not really be there.
Yes, I think it's the enticement to engage in this form of schooling in the belief that if everybody, or the greater number the better, engage in this form of schooling, then things are going to be so much better. We will do so much better on international tests. We will do so much better in terms of economic growth and development. And the oddity is that there are very few indications that the measures of the last quarter of a century, roughly, that are all sort of flowing in this general direction have improved things at all. There are some indications of improvement, but, you know, certainly performance on international tests, for example, haven't certainly leaped into better levels.
And I might add that in many ways it has disimproved. Segregation is worse than it's been in many decades between white and non-white students. Segregation.
In what way is it worse?
Literally segregated. Literally, there are black schools and white schools.
And what has caused that?
Well, I think it's been caused by a number of things, including other economic developments, which, of course, is the background to all of this. School can't solve economic problems in and of itself. It usually reflects economic problems. And I think the division of wealth, which is the second point I was going to get to, what is known as the achievement gap. Going back 20, 30 years, it was always white and black students and the achievement gap between them. Because one was middle class, basically, and the other was poor. Now it's switched, so the income disparity has been sort of, since the 70s at least anyway, has made it the case that economically, you know, most of the population is probably worse off compared to those at the top. than was true then. And that, again, is reflected in school, that the widest achievement gap now is between those who have money and those who don't have money. And so in many ways, you could say that, you know, the PISA scores and these things are irrelevant, because who knows what they're measuring anyway. And in many concrete ways, such as these social ramifications, things are worse as a result of standardization.
Cara, if I come back to you, and your presentation at the ESAI conference was on discourse analysis and the workshop model. What exactly is the workshop model?
The workshop model is an approach to teaching reading and writing in the classroom. And it's one that I've just become very interested in over the years, because as you talk about the three discourses, it fits most closely with the discourse of understanding and knowledge. And so then my own kind of area of interest is, okay, does it have the potential to move beyond that? Because essentially, it's a very child-centered approach to reading and writing. The whole notion is that children, you know, learn to read and write by actually doing those processes in the classroom and having the time to learn how to become stronger in the reading and writing area over time through their own kind of learning about themselves as readers and writers through choice and so on and so forth.
If we take the writing part first, what exactly is the workshop model as it would be applied for teaching writing?
Basically, it has kind of little different segments to it as you go through the day. So if you were implementing this in your classroom, you might start off with, we'll say, maybe a 5 to 10 minute share with the students, or a mini lesson. So you would demonstrate something for them, maybe, you know, how to integrate dialogue into your essay, or how to write in a certain genre, or write a piece of poetry or a certain kind of piece of poetry. And it's just this mini lesson that the teacher models, a little bit of student interaction, and then the students go off, and for the next portion of the class, depending on how much you have, it could be 20 minutes, 30 minutes, they go and do independent writing. And they may address in their writing what you just talked about in the mini lesson, but they don't have to. They might put that away for another time when it's relevant to their writing, but at least now they have that information. So the students are working, they're doing their independent writing. Some might be peer conferencing with one another, so they're getting feedback from one another. Others might be meeting with a teacher, and the teacher tries and moves around to get to as many of the students as possible within that 30-minute period. Sometimes the teacher might also decide to sit and write for that particular day, because part of it is this idea that you model how to engage in that writing process. And then the last few minutes would be, again, it could be student sharing. The student might get up and read what he or she has written for that day, or you could do a whole class share where everybody maybe just says a sentence that they wrote that day, or give a quick synopsis of what their topic is. So it can be done in different ways, but it's a coming back together again and a sharing of the authorship process.
And what age is that used with? What age children?
They start it from anywhere from kindergarten all the way up through middle school. It tends not to be used quite as much at the high school level. Certainly teachers might follow a workshop kind of approach if they're teachers of writing, but it seems to be typically more seen in elementary school and middle school, which would be the equivalent of kind of high infants through a second year here.
And what about then the workshop model for reading?
So very similar. It would follow a similar structure. A teacher might read something, then students go and they might do some independent reading. They might also do some collaborative work. So obviously part of a workshop model and engaging students in that reading process is to get them having those discussions with one another. But because it's student-led versus teacher-led, the teacher takes a back seat, becomes more of that facilitator, and lets students in small groups have their own discussions about the book that they might be reading. Or if they're reading different books, they might kind of sit together and talk about the theme or the genre or that they're reading together. So part of it would be just time for independent reading, then time for student group conversation, and then back again together as a whole group.
And when you conducted the research around the workshop model, was it the children's discourse you were looking at or teacher's discourse?
It was the teacher's discourse. So I was looking at three specific textbooks, actually, teacher resources that were written by three very prominent educators in the field who have taken this workshop model, have developed it further, have implemented it in their own classrooms, but in the case of Lucy Calkins, she has also brought it to many other classrooms as well. Yeah, she's kind of created her own program around it, actually.
And have the other two teachers published on it?
Yes, they've all published on it.
Who are the others? Lucy Calkins was one.
So Lucy Calkins is one of the authors that I examined. Linda Reef, her book that I examined is called Seeking Diversity. And Nancy Atwell, I looked at her book In the Middle. And the Lucy Calkins book that I looked at is The Art of Teaching Writing. And the reason I chose those books is because each of these authors' cases kind of some of their major works earlier on in that workshop process. And I'm also interested not only in the workshop itself, but also the evolution of the workshop over time. So I decided to start with the earlier set of works, so to speak, and I'm going to work my way forward from there.
Donal Lee, if I come back to you, you gave a presentation on how policymakers in the United States don't listen so much to the education community, and we've kind of touched on that. Can you say a little bit more about that?
In short, I think that is a fair statement to make, and the paper I had just spoken about was, again, developing some of the themes that I have mentioned earlier. When I have college students coming in, one of the things that crops up is kind of a similar response, which is, if teachers are saying this isn't working, and educators of other stripes are also saying this isn't going to work or isn't working, why do they keep going forward? Their argument seems to be illogical, and it is on the surface, but if you look at it more deeply, you realize it's perfectly logical, because what they're actually trying to do is measure public schools in such a way that they can't really measure up, and then kind of use this quote-unquote failing as an excuse to privatize public schooling. So they're really looking to turn public schools into another sector of the economy. And you can see this in with the Secretary DeVos, you know, not wanting to put any more money after public schools. They've proven to be a disaster. There's many organizations you could point to. One of them is known as ALEC, is the American Legislative Executive Council. They're an organization that basically promote the idea that one of their key points, if I'm not mistaken, on their website is that legislatures basically should do more to promote school choice. And the school choices they offer as a key point include vouchers, charter schools, homeschooling.
And what are the vouchers? Sorry.
Well, sorry, okay. Basically, money you get from the government that would be equivalent to how much they'd spend on you or child in the public school. And you can take that voucher then and spend it anywhere else. But in their key points, they offer about four or five issues that legislators should be looking at, and none of them include public schooling. And so this is an organization now that will go back to the very people who fund these legislators' campaigns and tell them who's been listening, basically. And so that's why the education community isn't really listened to as much as it should be. And I'm not trying to say there's no influence or that every legislator is blocking them out, but I'm talking about from a macro perspective, it's very clear. There's reason to hope that that will change and may be changing already. Certainly public opinion, I think, seems to be becoming more aware of the detrimental sort of impact of not listening to educators and teachers. But at the moment, it's the below the surface is that it's not about education, really. It's about controlling schools so that you can supplant them with a private system, which then is basically open for entrepreneurial exploration.
An interesting perspective there on developments in schooling in the United States from Donal E. Mulcahy, bringing this week's Inside Education to a close. On next week's programme, I'll be speaking some more to members of the Mulcahy family. If you'd like to listen back to this programme or to almost 300 other Inside Education programmes, you can log on to seandelaney.com/podcasts. My own book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available from Hodges Figgis and from online bookstores. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for tuning this way.